This is a Wisp Politics audio clip. For more, go to wisppolitics.com.
I wanted to ask you, I looked at your presidential campaign finance report yesterday, down to 140K, looks like you're still planning to pay it off. The fundraisers from November in Philly, New York probably weren't reflected in that.
Right, correct.
So I was curious, though, you're also ramping up the state fund or campaign a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a number you want to hit in 17 to kind of show that you're serious about the possibilities of 18? Or do you have to show people you're serious with your fundraising in 17?
Well, I think my past record shows we can raise a lot of money quickly. Our two parts. One, our goal was to be done at the end of the year, and the next report hopefully will show that our presidential stuff is on track. But in terms of the Friends of Scott Walker, I mean, I'll announce where my intentions are after I'm done with the budget, but I would imagine the report in July will show if I'm serious or not, just in terms of getting geared up, but I don't know there's a magic number.
Yeah. What's a serious number to you, though?
I leave that up to the campaign guys.
Okay. One thing I'm curious about...
They tell me what they need to spend. If I'm going to get in, they'll tell me what I need to spend, and then they figure out a plan how to raise it, and I go do it.
Do you have any concerns about trying to raise money after running for president or looking for a third term if people will be fatigued at all about the prospect?
No. I mean, people have been remarkable. Most of our donors are low-end donors. In the past, historically, we've had, I think, about 90% have been 100 bucks or less, or maybe about three-quarters. I don't know, it's 90%. It's been over three-quarters have been $100 or less. And so, those folks have been pretty consistent, particularly if we ran for another term. Those are the people that helped us out in the recall, they helped us in the reelect. They may or may not have been with us in the presidential. Some of them may have been, scattered amongst many candidates. But I think, again, if we run again, we'll face, to me, it doesn't matter who the opponent is. My real opponent will be the special interest groups, and some of those in particular based in Washington. And so I think people will be energized to help out.
Mm-hmm. I noticed at one point you said that 8 years is enough as governor, 10 years max. And then you obviously opened the door to doing 12. Mm-hmm. What changed? And this is even before there was a president-elect Trump, you kind of opened the door. So what changed your mind between saying 8 was enough to now maybe 12 is a good number?
Well, I've always, when I've talked in general, not about me, but about people ask about term limits or things, I've always said 12 is the magic number, mainly for Washington, because then the House and the Senate align. President's obviously already 8. Mm-hmm. But I would never go beyond 12. I think that's, third term, that's enough. The main interest, not so much on the years, but just on the possibility of another term if it were to happen, is in part what's going to happen in January, and that is you got a new administration aligned with the House and the Senate, aligned with not only me in Wisconsin, but two-thirds of all the country, who's got two-thirds have Republican governors and Republican legislative majorities. And I just look at the possibility, be it on Medicaid, transportation, education, workforce investment, the possibility that they'll send major portions or even all of those resources and responsibilities back to the states. To me, thinking about what we could do if given that chance is remarkable. I mean, now, in most of those areas, we're stuck with policies that are the same for New York, California, Texas, and even Illinois are different than Wisconsin, and yet we all are treated basically the same. I'd love to be governor, and obviously this one will happen right away, so not just for the remainder of this term, but what I think would inspire me to run again, amongst other things, would be the possibility that I could have 4 years of really being freed up to do things that are much more efficient, much more effective, and clearly more accountable at the state as opposed to the federal level.
So you said never more than 12, so maybe a third term, that would be it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, clearly would not run again after that. I mean, I'm probably pushing my luck with my wife to do a third term if I ran. There's no way if I ran anything after that, I'd be a bachelor. That would not be good.
So most of the talk about tax cuts in the next budget has been centered around whether you can do a tax cut to allow an offset for a gas tax increase. Mm-hmm. But as you put together your budget, I know you guys are probably getting close to finishing awesome sections now. Mm-hmm. Do you think you can you propose or will you propose any kind of tax cut in your budget in February when you propose it? Is there room for one in what you're looking at? Or do you want to do one?
Well, there's some very specific or narrow ones we've talked about. We would for sure do the sales tax holiday. We've talked about that before. That's a good thing leading into school start date. It'll also help retailers, particularly in state retailers. And beyond that, though, I think that the big thing, it's a big dollar item, but it may not seem as like a big thing because it's a given. We still have to put a sizable amount in to maintain our commitment for property taxes. My goal has been that property taxes will, on a median value home, will be less in 2018 than they were when I started. And so that's no small task financially. And even though that's not a flashy new tax cut, that's still a pretty sizable commitment.
So if there's going to be, besides the sales of God, there's going to be like an income tax cut or something, it'll be up to local lawmakers to find that money if they want to do it.
Well, never say never, but I'm right now my focus on new revenues is I'm going to overwhelmingly, once we pay off the things we have to, like Medicaid, although thankfully the Medicaid increase is looking like it'll be less than it has been the last couple budgets. Mm-hmm. Still an increase, but less. For me, all the additional revenue we can come up with should overwhelmingly go into K-12 public education, and then additionally what we can put into the UW and the tech college system tied to performance.
Now, you talk about property taxes. There's some talking about the personal property tax. Is that something on your agenda, or is that too pricing item with the other?
Well, it's about $250 million, and we're not going to push it off to the locals because that would be a tax, property tax increase, which we don't want to do. That means the state's got to come up with it. And again, if I had $250 million, I don't know that that would be the first place I'd put it.
So you mentioned UW. They're at 42.5 for their budget request. Mm-hmm. They're about, 78 or 87, one of the two, for the comp reserves, the pay increases mm-hmm. they want. Are those numbers that you can fit in your budget as you look at it, or is there going to be some?
We will give them an increase. It may include some of what they've asked for, but there'll be other things. I mean, we're going to tie an increase into performance metrics. I want to make sure that we're tying it into things like not only enrollment, but are people being enrolled in areas of high demand? Are they graduating? Are they getting employed in the state? Similar to some of the things we've done at our technical colleges. I just think it's really, really important. And we'll probably try and tie some of it into ways we can continue to make college affordable for students. It's the one of the many things I hear repeatedly. By tomorrow, I've done every county at least once on our listening sessions, and it comes up all the time. Affordability, not just in UW, but just in general, affordability of college. And so we'll try and address that even further.
But $120-some million, is that doable? Or does that be tough?
Well, again, we'll give them more, but it won't be necessarily in those areas, and it may or may not be at that amount. And on the comp reserve stuff, we'll probably, we've talked about giving a block grant before. We'll probably be more inclined to give them a pot of money and then have them determine how they're going to spend it in terms of things like compensation.
The discussion about transportation always comes back to the gas tax, seems like, but there are people who kind of bring up, for example, hybrids, that they're not paying a gas tax like I am. Do you think philosophically that there should be a higher registration fee for a hybrid, electric cars, those kinds of things because of that dynamic?
Well, there should be some way to account for it. I don't know if the registration fee is it. It might be. But hybrids and eventually electric cars, there's a whole bunch of things, most of which are fairly minimal in this budget, the differential, but eventually,
is there any
20 years from now, it'll be, I think, dramatically different.
Is there any wiggle room with your no fee increase pledge with those kind of vehicles because they're not paying a gas tax?
Oh, I think if you had some way to align what, on average it would cost to tie it into that, at least as a consideration. Because in those instances, I mean, the reason people pay a gas tax is not to fund the government in general.
Yeah.
It's particularly in light of the constitutional referendum question. It's that money is supposed to be for roads and bridges and other transportation-related projects. And so if an electric car or a hybrid is using the roads as much as anybody else, but they're not paying proportion or at all, I think it's responsible to align their use in the same way you do a car or a truck.
Even without a corresponding tax cut somewhere else, because it is kind of a unique circumstance?
Yeah, I mean, that's worth looking at. I don't know that we'll push it in this budget, because right now, even when we looked at it in the past, the differential is so marginal. Mm-hmm. To me, if you're ever going to address it, it probably would be not an add-on. It would probably be part of some, and I don't know the answer for this now, but some new way of aligning how we pay for transportation in the future.
Now, with the expected repeal of Obamacare, mm-hmm. does that make self-insurance less or more attractive? And is there less of a financial incentive to do it if it's repealed?
Well, it just removes one element of the discussion. If you don't have the premium tax issue, but there are plenty of other reasons. I mean, we just got a report the other day from the Commission on Government Reform Efficiency, and I forget the rest, reform efficiency and some other phrase. But, you know, one of the things they noted is that I think all but four states have self-insurance, and most employers, actually most healthcare systems in the state are health insured, if I recall right. So it's, I think it's a model that's worth looking at regardless of the Affordable Care Act.
Well, I interviewed Robin Voss yesterday. You talked about benefit changes, you know, looking mm-hmm. at, as you talked about, people who can't afford to take a job. He talked about looking for a waiver to do step downs, so you hit a certain income level, you mm-hmm. don't lose a benefit. Is that the path to
We've
do
looked
that?
At all sorts of different options. It's one of the people I have temporarily on my staff this past year who's been loaned to us has been great. We're going to push heavy duty welfare reform, entitlement reform, however you want to call it, entitlement in the sense of for state mm-hmm. benefits, that is. But yeah, we think, you know, one of the probably the top issue I'm going to face in the next couple of years is workforce. And this ties into it, that it's not just about, you know, making taxpayers happy, which it will, when fewer people are on public assistance. It's equally, if not more important in terms of the workforce, because we can help people transition to the workforce. And one of the barriers the speaker's right about is we hear it at listening sessions, we hear it elsewhere, are people who say they either can't hire people or they can't get people to take a promotion because they're worried about losing some of their benefits.
So then that is part of a possible solution to mm-hmm. that step down?
Yeah, we got a whole bunch of different options that we're looking at.
What's heavy duty? Like, how do you define heavy duty in terms of benefit reform? You've already done drug testing, you've already done
We've done this for child and adults. I mean, I think, you know, for us, we're looking at anybody who gets public assistance, looking at ways we can help transition people in the workforce.
So expanding these things to people who have kids?
Potentially, yeah.
I want to talk about presidency for a second. I've heard you say a number of times, the R has to be for reform. And since taking office, or the transition, I should say, you know, President Trump has brought in three guys from Goldman Sachs. We saw sort of this morning dropping Drain the Swamp. Is he at risk of losing touch with the populist sentiment that kind of brought him into office? You worry about that?
I think actions speak louder than words. So it's, in the end, it's not even so much who you put in your cabinet, it's what you do. I mean, I think as long as he and the Congress make major changes, they're going to do well. I mean, certainly what we did. I mean, part of the reason why a lot of people here in Madison didn't get it in the Capitol, but, you know, part of the reason why we won the recall and subsequently got reelected, part of the reason why Republicans in the legislature have gone three consecutive cycles adding seats is because we haven't let our foot up. We've been on the gas for almost 6 years now pushing reform, and people like that. Mm-hmm. So if the president-elect and the Congress aren't sitting on their hands, but they actually get things done, I think that more than anything else is going to make the public happy. Yeah.
So you said before, if you ran for president again, you wouldn't be a sitting governor when you did it.
Correct.
What's the other biggest lesson you learned after watching what happened to your campaign in this past year that you'd have to do better next time if you ran?
Well, I'd win.
How would you win?
I know things change so much. I mean, if that ever was a factor, 12, 16 years from now, I mean, I could wait 21 years and I'd still, actually 2 decades from now, I'd still be younger than the president-elect.
Is there anything different about message or campaign structure or things like that you learned and went, we could have done this better?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things that you thought were important work, things that, and vice versa. I mean, I think the bottom line, a lot of it's just timing. I mean, there are things I would have done differently, but even if we had addressed all those things, I still think it was his time. The timing was right for Donald Trump to win. It's why I got to the point I did ahead of the curve. And whether or not that time ever comes again for me or not remains to be seen. And certainly, as I said, as you correctly noted, I would not, and one of the many things I learned, though, was you can't be governor and you can't be at least the kind of governor I expect myself to be, which is engaged and run. I was never willing to abandon my role and responsibilities here. Even when I was traveling, I was still checking in all the time. And to do the things you need to do to be successful, it's essentially, if you want to be successful full-time, and I just couldn't do that.
I know he's getting antsy, so I'll finish up. But last thing I want to ask, you're looking at Donald Trump. You were not a fan of Donald Trump in September of 2015 when you dropped out. And that's right. Why you said Paul Ryan was not a fan of Donald Trump. You guys were there looking pretty happy at the rally last week. Are you embracing Trump or are you embracing the opportunity of what he represents for Republicans to change?
I've said since the morning after the election, it's not so much the person as it is the possibility. What I mean by that is, although I've grown to like Donald Trump over the past year plus, in many areas, I certainly don't embrace everything about him or the way that he goes about conducting himself, but I love the possibilities that are clear by having him in the White House and the House and the Senate that we wouldn't have had before. And again, while there are some things I'm concerned about occasionally, I also find, as I saw the other night in West Dallas, there are some things that to me are tremendously refreshing. Just the candor and he's clearly, he's not wed to anything in Washington. So there's no component of the status quo that I think, that's his Achilles heel. I mean, this is somebody who I think is willing to try just about any reform out there. I also think by and large, there might be an exception here or there, but I think by and large, he's put quality people. When I was overseas 2 weeks ago in Afghanistan and elsewhere, I got to tell you, the buzz, not only amongst American troops, but coalition troops, was Mattis. They couldn't stop talking about how great Mattis is. And you look at others out there, he's put, and man, a lot of business people, but I think that's good. These are people who were successful in operating and running big organizations. And my hope would be that they're the kind of people that can help clean up some of the mess in Washington.
And last quick follow-up. If things go awry, do you own, you break it, you own it. Trump breaks the Republican Party. Do you guys risk, by kind of embracing him, what that fallout could be?
No, because I think,
especially with you in 18.
Yeah, for me, no. I have two reasons on that. One, I think voters here in Wisconsin are really exceptionally engaged, probably as much as any state other than maybe New Hampshire. In fact, in the primary, we outdid everybody except New Hampshire in terms of turnout. So because of the last 6 years, we're very engaged, full spectrum. And I think voters are smart enough when they're engaged to know the difference between what one person says versus another, that they don't view everybody in the same category. And along with that, I just think, I actually believe that Trump and the Congress are going to do well. I think the economy is going to improve. You've already seen some indications, even the first few weeks after the election. The market has gone up. I think you see other indicators that suggest things are going well. Assuming they do what they say they're going to do, I think they'll do well. You know, if you see major tax reform, for example, and that encourages more American companies to bring work back from overseas, that puts more people to work and raises wages, all those things would be tremendously positive. If for some reason they don't, they'll blame the people who made those promises and then didn't do them. But I don't feel like I'm in that category. I think the one reason why even a lot of independents and discerning Democrats have voted for me in the past is even though they don't agree with me on everything, the one thing I do for sure is follow through on my promises.
Thank you, Governor.
Great.